Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution of the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
Welcome to the Capital Connection. I'm Alan Chartok. Our guest today is one of the best journalists in Albany, in New York State, Jimmy Vilkind, who covers New York State government for the Albany Times Union and its Capital Confidential blog. Jimmy Vilkind, welcome back to the show. Always a pleasure to have you here.
Always a pleasure to be on with you and your listeners.
Jimmy, let's start with the so-called Filegate story. It's the hottest thing in Albany right now. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how it all unfolded? Could you do that?
Of course. Well, so as your listeners might know, or they might have read in the Times Union or other publications that sort of followed the story,
including the New York Times, I may add.
I did read an article in the Times about it. My colleague Jim Odato and I set out to just examine some of the files that Andrew Cuomo kept as attorney general. And now by law, those files go to the state archives. There is no law for gubernatorial records, but there is a law for records of our state's attorneys general who work and essentially run the Department of Law. And literally, we were fishing. We wanted to see what we could see. We didn't have any thing in mind. We weren't aware of any smoking gun or anything that was in these files.
Nobody said, if you go here and look on page 12 of your newspaper, if you go here, follow the money and you'll find something.
Well, we you know, as reporters, sometimes we do this. You know, it's public information. We wanted to review what we could review and see what was what.
Sure.
And what we found was just having an incredible amount of difficulty finding and reviewing these materials. So I think I actually submitted, I first requested this sometime in early January. And there's another guy named Michael Keller, who was a student journalist with a publication called The New York World, who did the same thing, and he was looking. And we were told, oh, you have to file a Freedom of Information request for that. So we did. We then found out that we filed it at the wrong place, and that they didn't forward it along. They just kind of let it sit on a desk, and it's still languishing there. So finally, in late March, I went to the archives and personally hand-delivered a Freedom of Information Law request, which I was told we needed to do, and that sort of got the ball rolling. What was eventually produced to us was about a dozen boxes, in addition to more boxes about a lawsuit that we opted not to review. We just didn't care much about this particular lawsuit. And so in total, probably less than 75 boxes was the sum total of all records that Attorney General Andrew Cuomo, in his 4 years in office, in that office, had sent to the archives roughly 18 months after leaving that office.
And that seemed like a small amount compared to the work product that they put out in the Attorney General's office.
Well, it's hard to make such a blanket comparison. We know that Attorney General Spitzer, who served 2 terms in office, sent over 1,000 boxes. Wow. And by about this time, after he'd been out of office about this long, those had already been sent over. And so we were given these materials, and most of them were routinely available. Most of them were things that you could find on the internet, press releases, research documents, etc. And there was one box that was of particular interest to us. It contained the daily calendars and schedules of a woman named Ellen Bibin, who was in charge of the Public Integrity Unit when Andrew Cuomo was Attorney General, who later...
Now, say, Public Integrity Unit, just to get this straight, in Andrew Cuomo's office.
Yes. It's the Public Integrity Bureau of the New York State Attorney General's office. Yes.
Great.
And she then became the Inspector General, and she's currently the Executive Director of something called the Joint Commission on Public Ethics, which is the chief lobbying and ethical watchdog in Albany right now. And so there were some interesting things in there and some interesting documents that we reviewed. And
what made them interesting?
Well, they were the most revealing. It was interesting to see who Ms. Bibin was meeting with. It was interesting to see some of the cases that have, of course, become public and have unfolded now, see how they unfolded, to see what meetings were taking place, to see what the updates were. We also found a 7-page memo that was prepared by a woman named Linda Lacewell, another top lieutenant of then Attorney General Cuomo in the Attorney General's office, detailing the travel records scandal that is often referred to as Troopergate. And this unfolded in the summer of 2007, actually right when before I was a political reporter for the Times Union, but it was just as I had been hired in another capacity by the paper. And we thought this was interesting because it describes some of the investigative techniques and gave an overview of the investigation of what became a fairly major thing that dominated the headlines for a long time and prompted the resignation and the subsequent fining of a couple of then Governor Elliot Spitzer's top aides. So this was interesting, but after we made a photocopy of it, when you go to the State Archives, if anyone wants to go to State Archives, which is great, they have wonderful, wonderful, incredible resources going back to, you know, the Dutch colonial era in New York. There are certain rules, and these materials are restricted. You know, you can't bring in a pen, for example. You have to write in pencil, and you can't bring like envelopes because they don't want you to be taking documents out or concealing things. But upon request, they'll make photocopies for you. You have to pay something like 25 cents a page. So we thought, oh, this is a good thing. We want to have it and review it. And so we made a photocopy of it. And that action apparently ran up the flagpole. The fact that Mr. Odato and myself and maybe another colleague had been at the archives reviewing these records. I got a phone call on Friday evening after business hours saying, well, you've seen things that you shouldn't have been able to see. And I was kind of confused by this.
Can you just help us a little bit, Jimmy? From whom did you get the phone call?
It was an aide, someone employed by the archives.
Oh, by the archives.
Right,
not the governor's office.
Yeah.
Presumably, though, we figure that the archives got a call from the governor's office or made a call to the governor's office, which led to your getting a call from the archives.
I don't know that to be the case, actually.
Okay, I'm going to just hypothesize that.
Okay, well, you're welcome to do so.
Thank you, Jimmy.
So let me take one step back quickly. So there are documents in the archives that are not released to the public. Right. For example, the Office of Mental Health has mental health files on various patients in state care. Those are not publicly available. In that case, under specific parts of statute, they're private medical records. I have no right to see someone else's mental health file. And then that prohibition, I believe, applies for 75 years. But there are also several exemptions in the Freedom of Information Law, which generally governs the release of these records from the archives. And, for example, a document that contains information that might compromise an ongoing investigation, a criminal probe, that would not be released. Something that constitutes an unwarranted invasion of personal privacy, that would not be released. In the same manner where if I were to ask a government agency for these records in kind of real time, they would be able to withhold or redact those records subject to these certain exemptions. But they're broad. This language is broad. And so exactly what falls under these exemptions is subject to interpretation. And some of them include communication between agencies, sort of deliberative communications. If someone sends a memo to, if I send an email to my editor to say, hey, I think we should do this, it's a proposal, those types of things can be shrouded under one of the exemptions. And also attorney work product can be shrouded under some of these exemptions. So we were told that we saw things that we were not supposed to see. And this was after our initial request had already been screened for several weeks by officials at the archives and an attorney with whom they consulted. And numerous, I think probably over a dozen files had been pulled from what we were able to see that they, in their official response to us, said were withheld under these various exemptions under the Freedom of Information Law. And so this phone call, they said, you saw things you weren't supposed to see. You saw things you weren't supposed to see. And I kind of said something along the lines of, you know, it's 7 o'clock. I'm at dinner with my family.
Sent up a red flag.
Yeah. And so on Monday, when we returned to the archives, we were told we could see none of the materials. And a few days later, we were able to get back access to them. And a lot of the documents that we had found most interesting had been pulled again. So we started thinking, you know, who did this review? What happened here? Who's responsible for this review? And what we found out was, and at first, archives officials would not tell us who had done the actual review of these materials. They said that it was an attorney. That was all that they would say. But we subsequently found out that it was Ms. Lacewell, who remains a top aide to now Governor Andrew Cuomo. And so this set off a series of questions about, well, what is the normal procedure? Why was someone who reports directly to Governor Cuomo given the responsibility of essentially pre-screening which of his archival materials should be released to the public, especially when you look at the state statute and say that the archives, which is part of the state's Department of Education, is by law independent from the governor's office, that the state education department reports to the Board of Regents, which is appointed by the majority of the state legislature. So this raised a red flag to us. And Mr. Odato and myself started to try to put in context what was happening. We asked for written procedures, if there was some sort of set of guidelines about the review for these kinds of records. And the only document that was produced to us was a 2006 Memorandum of Understanding between the state archivist, Ms. Christine Ward, and a top aide to then Attorney General Elliot Spitzer, which was signed essentially as the Spitzer administration was transitioning from Attorney General to Governor. And the rough procedure of that memo was, if someone requests documents from the archives, then the archivists review and see what's responsive. Then if they have questions or they require legal assistance, they contact the Department of Law. They contact people in the Office of Attorney General, and they look through, and theoretically these people look through and whatever. And then they make the decisions, and then it goes back to the archives, and then the person, John Q. Public, is granted access to these materials. Essentially, the Attorney General, in this case, Mr. Spitzer, has no say. He and his assistants don't get any kind of review. They theoretically know nothing of the request. And I know that in the course of this week, Mr. Spitzer has been interviewed by several other media outlets and has essentially said that this is the way it should be and that he should have no say over it. And if we think about if then Attorney General Spitzer had lost the 2006 gubernatorial election to John Faso, so if he had essentially become private citizen Elliot Spitzer, he would have no claim to these materials, and he would have no claim to reviewing of these materials, which are essentially publicly owned, publicly generated records. Mr. Cuomo and his administration have apparently taken a different view. They feel that they explained to the Times Union that they are in the best position to know which of these materials should be released and which should not be released, and therefore they should be the ones doing the review. And they also added that additional materials that are being sent to the archives are being pre-screened by them just to facilitate and streamline the process of their public release. But other people involved in sort of public records in the archives community have said that this is concerning. Lawrence Hackman, who was previously the state archivist under, I should say, another governor named Cuomo, Governor Mario Cuomo, he said that this was deeply concerning and that this sort of idea of pre-review. I spoke with someone familiar with the federal archiving process, and he said that essentially at the national level, the review is done by archivists, and they have more resources, so they theoretically, I believe, have attorneys that could do the review of themselves that are full-time attorney employees of the archives. That's not the case in the state of New York. But that the review is independent of whatever official, be it Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy or President George W. Bush. It's independent of the public officials, so that the decision is made by historians with the ideal of maintaining that balance between privacy and the needed privacy for some parts of government, but also for public disclosure. Keeping
Let me
in mind.
Go back on this, Jimmy, for one second and remind everybody that we're talking to Jimmy Vielkind, ace reporter for the Times Union newspaper. We're discussing something called Filegate.
I haven't heard that, Alan. But.
Called Filegate, which is that the then Attorney General Andrew Cuomo becomes governor. Now the Times Union starts, for want of a better word, snooping around files that are in the archives. And all of a sudden, stuff starts disappearing from the archives. And you already have a facsimile of one particular memo.
Correct.
So let's go to that for a second. We've got 10 minutes left in the show, and I don't want people hanging out there with their tongues hanging out of their heads saying, oh, boy, I want to hear the end of this story, because it's just like all the president's men. We're following the whole thing here. Go ahead.
Well, so this seven-page memo seemed to spark the most interest and seemed to be, you know, for lack of a better term, the most sexy of the documents that we were able to review.
Yeah.
And in our initial article about the pre-screening that happened at the archives, Mr. Odato and I made reference to the memo, but we did not quote from it. We did not publish it. We did not reveal it. And that was in Sunday's editions of the Times Union.
Right.
in subsequent days, we decided that since we had acknowledged the presence of this memo, since other publications were writing about the presence of the memo, and since Mr. Spitzer himself had been quoted on the record saying he believed that this memo showed that the Troopergate investigation was unfairly tilted to his
flawed.
I don't recall his exact line. Okay. I don't have it in front of me. But yes, but he called into question the investigation and said it broke against
him. And it was about him. So,
So he had a vested interest,
yes.
Of course.
Yes.
We decided that it would make sense to publish that memorandum, and we did put it on our Capitol Confidential blog.
Were you warned by the governor's office not to publish it?
I know that the governor's office in our reporting for this story had maintained that these records were disclosed to us in error and that they should not have been disclosed and they should not have been made public.
Gotcha. Which made everybody immediately, Jimmy, say, what's going on here? What is in this memo that is so potentially damaging that the Cuomo people are putting all of this effort into keeping it quiet? And now I know a little bit about it. I did talk to Elliot Spitzer. You want to tell us what was in the memo?
Well, the memo essentially outlined, and it was written on August 16th by, coincidentally or not, Ms. Lacewell, the woman who was doing the review.
Uh-huh.
The memo essentially outlined the procedure for the first aspect of Andrew Cuomo's report on Troopergate. Now, the so-called Troopergate affair started on July 1 of 2007 when Mr. Odato, it's amazing how, there's only seven people who live in the state of New York, I'm convinced.
You're referring to your colleague, Jim Odato, who's a terrific reporter and a real bulldog.
Right. And so when he published an article essentially asserting that then-Senate Majority Leader Joe Bruno was using state aircraft to attend political events, and that on the days that he attended these political events, he often did state business. But it called into question, well, if he's using these aircraft, these public resources to take official business, like a meeting in New York City, for example, is it appropriate for him to also be attending a political event, such as a fundraiser? And at the time, there were not really guidelines in place governing this. And so this memo detailed that part of the report and how investigators from the Office of the Attorney General examined whether or not Bruno's flights had occurred when there was official business. And there was one line in the memorandum that essentially said that one thing in the memorandum was not included in the report, which it turns out was not accurate. It turns out that the memorandum was wrong, that the item in that the memo revealed was actually in the report on a much later page. But Mr. Spitzer seized on this, and again, he said that it pointed to serious flaws with the Troopergate report that Cuomo had put out about him. But you asked, what were they hiding? And I want to answer that in two ways. The first way is to say and to repeat for your listeners what the Cuomo administration explained why they withheld the document. And that was because it represented an attorney work product and an internal communication, and therefore it should be shrouded under the Freedom of Information Law. And the second way I want to answer it is to say it's not a smoking gun, that there is something that could lead to questions and perhaps inquiries, but they're also questions that have answers. And indeed, as I just said, they've been answered by the Cuomo administration. So the answer is, I don't think that there's anything particularly damning about this memo. And
well, okay,
so,
let me just take a little parenthesis here, a gulp of air. The Allen understanding of this was that, of course, Andrew Cuomo and Elliot Spitzer have had their issues in the past, political
mm-hmm.
issues,
mm-hmm.
and they are potential and they were political rivals
mm-hmm.
Within the Democratic Party, it is true. Now, the question is, when Joe Bruno used the state plane to go to wherever he was going, did he have other business at the same time, state business as well as political business, which he was doing?
Mm-hmm.
If he only used the state plane for politics, then it would have been inappropriate to charge it to the people of New York. And apparently in one of these cover memos back and forth, there was one line, at least that's my understanding, that, as you said, it turned out not to be true, but that we did not mention something which might have, in fact, given Spitzer the benefit of the doubt.
Yes, that's certainly Spitzer's version of it, and
yes,
that's certainly been the version of others. The Cuomo administration has noted that Troopergate has been investigated and reinvestigated many times.
True.
And its central conclusions have always been upheld. And the central conclusions of Mr. Cuomo's report, dated July 23rd, 2007, have always been upheld. But what we focused on, and I think what is the takeaway for listeners, without kind of rehashing events of 5 years ago, is this idea of pre-screening and this idea of should officials, like officials such as Governor Cuomo, should they have the ability to be pre-screening things in the archives? Now, I know some people listening probably heard the Vox Pop where you had Bob Freeman, who is the the director of the Committee on Open Government and real expert in the freedom of information law. And he told us, as he told your listeners, that this is legal, that there is nothing legally improper about what was done. But the question that we've put to some good government groups and to other people within the archives community is, well, what's assuming and accepting that it is legal, is it proper? Is it something that we feel is politically proper and governmentally proper? And I think that that's an open discussion because some of them have said, no, we don't think that an official should have this option to pre-screen. We think that it should be a more objective third party. And going forward, I think that that's a conversation that we may be revisiting. And I think it's a conversation that's going to come into very, very, very sharp focus, especially as Andrew Cuomo, who has promised to run the most transparent and open administration in New York, moves toward a possible leap to a higher political platform, be that a run for president, be that a possible appointment in some sort of national office, which, based on his record in New York, I think most people mention is a distinct possibility.
Yes, but something made them get crazy about all of this, which, of course, turns out to be very counterproductive because guys like me and other people are now calling this Filegate. And they are spending enormous amounts of resources fighting with the New York Times, fighting with the Times Union about this. All it does to me, if I'm a political advisor to Cuomo, which of course I'm not, I would be saying, what are you doing? All you're doing is making this whole thing much more noticeable, and it makes you look like you got something to hide.
Well, and I think that what you're alluding to is true. I think that what this has done is created a, if not a counter-narrative, then certainly contrary data points on the issues of transparency and on the issues of government transparency. Now, when Governor Cuomo, you know, looks on his administration, he's very explicitly an ends guy, not a means guy. He says, judge me by what I've done. I have lowered middle class income tax rates. I have imposed a property tax cap. I have passed two state budgets on time. I have legalized same-sex marriage. And he has a litany of accomplishments to which he points and to which he has been roundly lauded and for which voters at the polls and in public opinion polls that we see offer their support of him. But at the same point, we see these questions about his means and these questions about his transparency. And they run as a perhaps parallel, perhaps perpendicular track to his record on government transparency, where he points to the 2011 Public Integrity Reform Act, which has unprecedented disclosure for state officials, including mandating that state legislators and other government officials disclose the amount of their outside income. So I think that this is something that runs in a different track as Governor Cuomo talks about transparency. And it's certainly something he's going to have to deal with that he probably would rather not.
Well, to me, the issue now becomes one of political prowess. You know, when Andrew Cuomo was the chief advisor to his father, he got himself a reputation as a bit of a tough guy. And then when he got elected governor, everybody went around and did stories on, is it the old Andrew or the new Andrew? Interestingly, I think this shows the old Andrew as opposed to the new, more mature Andrew, which he claimed he had done. In effect, does character change? Anyway, Jimmy Vielkind, Freud didn't believe character change, and I don't believe character changes, and I believe this is going to be a very interesting ongoing discussion. We'll be delighted to have you and to have James Odotto maybe at the same time on to talk about this as it develops. Our guest on the Capital Connection has been Jimmy Vielkind, who covers New York State government for the Albany Times Union and its Capital Confidential blog. Jimmy, thank you so much for being with us.
Alan, it's been a pleasure.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. Ian Pickus is producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare online at nysut.org. and NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign. Online at nyscasa.org.